oh my God, am I losing out on a great opportunity here, and am I making the right choice?
Welcome to the Breaking Bias podcast, formerly Diversity on Fire, the show where we explore the stories and experiences of people from all walks of life. We are on a mission to inspire new thoughts and dialogue in an effort to challenge bias and cultivate connection. I'm your host, Heather, and joining the conversation today is Farah. Farah is a longtime banking professional, a baker, a yogi, and author of the newly published book, Meher and Me, a mother-daughter relationship memoir about the life we choose for the lessons we will learn. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Heather. Happy to be here.
I always like to start the show by having you share with us your origin story. So when I say origin story, I'm looking at, you know, your formative years, essentially up to age 25, your story of growing up and any impactful events that you feel helped shape who you became.
Sure. I think that might just take us through most of the show, because my early years up to the age of 25, there was a lot happening. So for your listeners, obviously, they'll hear I'm not American. I was born in London, where of Parsi faith, and Parsis are the Persians that came from Persia before it became Iran and took asylum in India. And both my parents are Parsis. My mom was born in India. My father was actually born in Johannesburg. And they met at a wedding, fell in love, got married. And I was born in London. And aged four, my mother sent me to see my maternal grandmother for the winter months. The intention was to spend a month or a couple of months. But when my mom joined me there, she was informed that my father was being unfaithful, and he had quit his job, and he was, you know, just not being his best self, shall we say. And so she made the decision not to return to England, and we stayed in India. And as the days became months, she sort of decided that I needed to go to school, because, you know, I was nearly 5 years old at that point, and I needed to be in school. So I was sent to an Irish convent in the middle of this little town in northern India. The missionaries had come to India many, many years ago and had set up schools, and it's the equivalent of a private education, especially if you want an education in the English language. And it's the school my mom had gone to, and I went to the same school. So that to me was one of the pivotal sort of moments, because it's about displacement. I had gone age 4 and a half, turning 5. I didn't speak the language. I didn't speak Hindi. I looked a little bit different. Parsis, through our features, we don't look as you might imagine, you know, Indian people to look. We retain our Persian features, you know, the prominent profiles, which are joked about. And just even the way we speak, there's a different accent that we have. And so it was, I was in India. I didn't speak the language. I was sent to school. It was difficult to sort of find the sense of belonging straight up. And it took me a long while to figure out how I was meant to navigate the society, where my place in that society was. Also, my father was absent, physically absent, emotionally and financially absent as well. And that we're talking nearly 50 years ago, right? It was a small town, separation, divorce. Those were not commonplace words at all. So by virtue of the actions of my parents, I was different. And by virtue of how I looked or spoke or didn't speak the language, I was different. So there was this whole sense of navigating that identity crisis that comes in with the sense of displacement and just your foundation not being very solid as a child. And then the years passed, and obviously I learned how to speak the language, went to school, grew up. And then when I was 18, there was a decision point on which passport to retain, because there was no dual nationality. So it was a question of, do I stay in India or do I go back to the UK? And clearly, I wanted to go back to the UK, because in my head, India was only ever temporary. London was home. So we made the decision for me to go. And that was, you know, for me, it was exciting. I remember my mother crying copious amounts of tears, but I wanted to be a doctor. So I had studied science and I got to the UK. And again, back in the UK, it's a sense of belonging and finding my feet again. Even though I was born, they had been absent for 14 years. And it's how do you, as an adult child, now come back in and find a way of being, from the way you dress to the corporate culture to how you interact with your peer group. It was a very different way of being compared to India, for example. I couldn't pursue my dream of becoming a doctor because my parents had been out of the country. And so I had to pivot. And as is in most cases in life, the universe takes you down different roads to the ones you might imagine. And I ended up as a trainee in the financial industry, in banking. And I've built my career from there. So again, another pivotal moment in terms of adjusting, adapting, but also having to adjust to what life is throwing at you, which is not necessarily how you might have imagined it or how you might have planned, but riding that wave and just finding the perseverance and the grit to get up and keep going without actually knowing where this route is going to take you and where you're going to end up. Like, I had no way of knowing then where I might end up 30 years down the line in the same industry. It was driven by the need to be financially independent, which links into emotional security for me, but also I had to be self-sufficient given the financial circumstances in the family. So quite a few sort of pivotal decision points, but I think what I also want to recognize is that time in India gave me a very, very rich upbringing. I might not have been as appreciative of that opportunity as a child, but I think as an adult in a Hindu town or Hindu culture, Muslim town, Christian, school, Parsi faith at home, you can't help but absorb all of those influences, and they just sort of amalgamate. It isn't differentiated. It's very matter of course and very matter of fact. And we're just being with our friends who may be of a different faith, and we join them in that faith. So it's given me a very wide perspective to be able to understand people have different upbringings, different conditioning, different life experiences, which then informs their choices or, to use the word of your show, their biases or their thinking, because they've seen one particular way, they think that's the only way. But my upbringing, and by virtue of having lived in India and London and now in Dubai for the last 20 years, I'm able to navigate the geographies and the cultural nuances a little easier.
So this is fascinating to me. When we think back to when you were going to school, and so you went to a Catholic school. You mentioned it's a historically Muslim area or town, city. And then there was a lot of representation of Hindu as well. So the way you just described it to me, it sounds like, your friends were of other faiths and it didn't matter. Do you feel like that was representative of the area because there were so many different influences in regards to other people? Do you feel like other people felt like those blurred lines were perfectly acceptable as well in that area?
For sure, in my family social circle, because the social circle comprised of all of these people of different faiths, so it was perfectly accepted. In the morning at assembly, we would say the Hail Mary. Back at home, it might be different. If my Hindu friends were celebrating Diwali, all of us participated. Or if it was Eid and the Muslim friends were celebrating, all of us participated. So it was very natural for all of us to be part of each other's faith and cultural events and highlights. And, nobody gave it a second thought. I mean, India by its constitution is a secular socialist republic, and that was the whole sort of ethos of the independence movement. So I just feel for us, it was very commonplace. I know there are greater divides in society perhaps today, born of religion or political points of view, but those were never ours. Ours was very inclusive.
I love hearing that so much. Especially because you've had that experience, and not just that experience growing up, but because you've lived in other places. I'm curious if when you come across people who do have bias because maybe they haven't had that experience, and so they're only used to or accepting of their way, I'm curious if you think you notice that more because you don't operate like that. It's kind of a weird backwards question, but I hope that makes sense.
No, I do. I notice it, and part of me feels a sense of regret on their behalf that they haven't had a wider perspective, but I appreciate, and I might, like, if I'm close enough to them, I might, you know, say, have we considered this, or have we considered a different point of view, to expand that thinking. But I also recognize that people can be quite set in their ways. And I think, you know, at a certain age, you kind of think, okay, I know it all, or I've seen it all, or this works for me, or I don't want to try something different. So it's kind of, I see it, I recognize it, but I also appreciate the limitation that exists on me being able to change as much of it. I can always say, but I've seen something different, or I've experienced different, or I have a different point of view, and, you know, disagree or put forward a different thought process. But there's no guarantee that they will accept or acknowledge or appreciate it. So one has to sort of read the room, so to speak.
Certainly. Yeah. And that's something that I navigate a lot in terms of just my own being and desire to impact positive change, but also understanding that I can't expect people to meet me where I am in my journey, because there was a time when I wasn't there either. So it's a really interesting road to navigate. And on that note, events in our life can make a big impact in shifting our perspective, understanding things in a different way. And you certainly experienced a major life event, 2006, so about 17 and a half years ago or so, with the death of your mother. Would you share that story with us?
Sure. So, you know, all of us are going to pass at some point, but I think when it's untimely and unexpected and slightly brutal in how it happens, I think it leaves everyone in the wake, you know, very, very shaken up, and it takes everyone, it makes that grief harder to digest, to process, to get over, because the senselessness of the situation or the incident, you know, that sort of stays and lingers for a long, long time. So it was a question of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. My mother was out in the evening, and she had driven to pick up my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, and there were some gentlemen lurking around. And India has this propensity for gentlemen to think they can make sexual innuendos, comments, gestures, you know, overtures towards ladies. And it's a question of personal security and safety, and the woman needs to be able to feel safe and doesn't. And, you know, invariably the question would become, what was the girl wearing, or did she do anything to invite that behavior, which is very distressing. But my mom saw these guys say something. She didn't actually hear, so she came out of the car. Mom was a lawyer, very feisty, very pro women's rights, and just, you know, felt she could. So she stepped out of the car to confront these gentlemen. And what she didn't realize, and none of us knew at the time, is they had been obviously drinking. They might have been using some other substances. There were four of them. Three of them apologized. Mom threatened to call the police. And she was like, you know, you need to apologize to the lady. This is no way to behave. And, you know, your mothers and sisters, and, you know, all of that dialogue that one would. And the four, they ran away when she threatened to call the police, and the fourth one, who didn't apologize, turned around, came back, pulled out a gun, and shot my mother at very close range. And the way the bullet went in, you know, obviously from the impact, she fell down and there was bodily sort of damage, and it went in through her vertebra, so she was paralyzed on one side. And through her wounds and her injuries, no one expected her to survive the day, the night. She was airlifted into Delhi. I was in Dubai at the time, so I flew into Delhi. And she survived for 25 days, and her mind was alert, at least for the first, you know, 21, 22 days. And she knew everything that was happening around her. And means the courage of her, when the police were questioning her, she said, I would do the same thing if I was put in the same situation again. And then she passed from her internal injuries and the bleeding, and the doctors were unable to locate the source. But when you sort of lose someone in that horrific manner, means there's the loss, but there's also the incident and the trying to comprehend how could something like this happen to someone like us, or to my mother, or why, and the hows, and, you know, all those questions that you don't necessarily get answers to, but you've got to find a way to just keep moving and going. And eventually with time, that the way she passed doesn't define her legacy. So today I will remember her as warm and loving, and my mother, and vibrant and, you know, beautiful and intelligent and all the characteristics that went into defining her as a person, rather than just the ending. But it took a long time for me to be able to speak today. It's taken a very long time. They say you tell the story different when you've healed, but it's taken me a very long time to heal.
I can only imagine. So I appreciate you being willing to share that story. When we think about major events like that and how seemingly senseless it is, right? It's senseless because she was simply doing the right thing. It's, you know, I love that you guys had the opportunity to have this conversation and she got to share, you know, what transpired. It brings me to this human condition that I always say I'm fascinated by, and I am, and I'll never understand it. I don't think any of us will ever fully understand it. But this hierarchy dynamic, this superiority dynamic, this power and control that seems to captivate a great number of people and often is exacerbated when substances are involved. When that happened, you know, after your mom's passing, how did you navigate that? What changed and what did you have to change in order to move through that?
So when I came, so mom passed, I stayed in India for a bit and then I came back to Dubai and I was working. My kids were younger at the time. So it was a question of you're moving through the motions of your day-to-day life, but you're not actually fully there. It was like my eyes were constantly skimming the horizon for a sight of my mother, knowing full well she wouldn't be there. But it's, they say your eyes look for the soul that's passed, just for a glimpse. And you're there, but not fully there, because part of you is still grieving. And to process that grief, you know, I did things like therapy or holotropic breathwork or a lot of journaling, a lot of just movement-based, so a lot of yoga, to just try and get in touch with what I was feeling, to describe it, to define it. I don't know if I had the words to, or the vocabulary to capture the depth of the emotion or the loss or the despair or the, you know, just everything that sort of surrounds you at the time while still, you know, trying to work, looking after the children, you know, presenting sort of as if you're holding it all together while actually not really holding it all together, but not being able to let it all out till you're in a safe place in, say, wherever you choose that safe place to be. So it was a lot of just allowing time to pass. And they say time heals. And yes, time helps you get through it. I don't know if it so much heals, but it allows you to find a different way of being. So without mom there, I had to learn to become more self-sufficient. I had to learn to be able to process my own emotions. I didn't have her to pick up the phone to and say, something's happened, what do I do? Or I'm so mad, or, you know, I'm so happy. Have you heard, you know, I wanted to share this with you. So it was a lot about learning to become more self-sufficient, because my father had been absent since I was four and, you know, remained absent. So I think the only thing that would probably have changed is the need to, or to find a way of being without my mother. Then our parents are our foundation for the most part, right? And they witness our lives as we evolve, and the good and the highlights and, you know, the milestones in our lives. And without that parent there, you just have to find a different way of being.
Your mom had a very interesting theory, or I don't know if theory is the right word, but you've quoted her saying that we choose our lives for the lessons we learn. And I'm guessing she's meaning that spiritually. I'm wondering if you can dissect that and help us understand how you understand it. Because to me, especially with this event and other life events, it feels really hard to consider that.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. It is spiritually. So she was very spiritual, and she believed that before we come into the life, the souls sort of make a contract on what they're going to experience in this life with other souls playing a part in that learning journey. So they say life is not random. We come into these lives for particular interactions, connections, people we meet, lessons we learn. And then we become, you know, as the years go on, we learn these lessons and we develop into the version of ourselves that I think we're meant to become through having traversed these life lessons and these pathways. So it was very in the spiritual context. If I ever said, you know, something was happening, or I'd say to her, you know, I can't believe somebody did something like that. And she would be like, just remember, you chose this life. Or especially if she was driving me mad, she would say, just remember, you chose me as your mother. We used to laugh about it. But I think as I grow older, I recognize the truth in that more and more, because I don't believe I would be the person I am today if I hadn't learned some of the lessons I learned. I might not be able to navigate the geographies and the cultures and the people and characters with as much ease if I hadn't been exposed to that variety in my childhood years. And that came as a result of my parents separating. So therein, with that lesson, came the gift as well. So I think there is definitely a truth in it.
Okay. And as you say that, I feel like that does make sense, is we can accept it more once we embrace who we've become because of. But I think what my brain wants to do, and perhaps this is what the challenge that other people have, is when you read that, you want to think about a past event in your present body, but that's not how you were or who you were when that event happened. So it's this interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
Now, you had the book just came out this year, right?
Correct.
In April.
Yeah, correct.
Tell us about that. What made you decide to write it, and how was the process for you?
I mean, I have to say straight up, it was a long process to get it, to publish it. So the story came about, literally the words just started tumbling out and I was typing, and it was the heart of the story that comes first, which is my mother and the incident around her passing. And then I built the story out from that. And it didn't take me that long to build the story in of itself. But then it was a question of, obviously, I've never written a book before, and I sought feedback and I reached out to the experts and I reached out to publishing houses and agents, and, you know, lots of feedback, lots of rejections. And so then it sat for a while in my bedside table drawer. And then I took it out and I thought, okay, let me, you know, revise it a little more. We reach out to hybrid publishers. Again, same sort of feedback. A lot of rejections again, a couple of offers as well, but they just didn't feel that they were the right approach for me at the time. And then this final time round, it was hopefully just a question of right place, right time. I met a couple of individuals, helped me edit the book, get the files, and help me self-publish and help me with the promotion of the book. So yeah, it's been a little bit of a journey, but definitely a labor of love, because it's mom's legacy that I'm trying to bring to life. I was a lot of it, I'm the spectator and a recipient of the outcome of the actions she's choosing to take in her life, not necessarily the person who initiates some of the actions. But she was this amazing human being that I hope the book and the story will bring to life.
I'm always curious about that part where you hear that a lot in publishing, that there's a lot of rejection. And I'm always curious about that part, because there's so much rejection. If you do get an offer, that's got to be, you have to be very secure in understanding what you want to align with to say no to something when you've had so many rejections. Because I think sometimes you can feel like, oh my gosh, I finally have an offer, and jump on it without considering if it aligns with you. What was that like for you in terms of getting that and then realizing, no, this isn't actually right?
That's really insightful. And that's really true. That is the emotional journey after. And when you're getting the rejections, I try and keep a distance between me, the person, versus this persona that's getting the rejections. And it's fine, you know, okay, another one bites the dust kind of approach, and I'm okay with it. But then when the offer comes, you get so excited, as you said. But I'm also very analytical, right? I've worked in finance and banking my entire life. So after that initial surge of excitement sort of comes down, then I sort of take the time to read the offer, the contract, and then look at the fine print and the small print and, you know, the little notes that have all these conditions that are maybe not as obvious straight up, which either they were limiting me in some way or they weren't allowing me to do the things I wanted to do, or they weren't allowing me the control on the narrative, or some aspect just did not resonate. And I am quite intuitive as well. So if it wasn't feeling right for me, I would sit on it, I would meditate on it, think about it, look at the pros and cons, like do the analysis, the theory part of it, and then go with the feeling as well. And if it was a no, then I didn't proceed. And you're right, it means there is that sense of, oh my God, am I losing out on a great opportunity here? And am I making the right choice? But at some level, I trusted my instincts as well as whatever other aspects there were that were concerning me in the first place. And that's kind of how I played it.
When we think about kind of circling back to your origin story, right? So all the experiences you had from the start, and you touched on it just a minute ago, but just to kind of expand on it, how do you feel like those early experiences have impacted your, I was going to say ability, so maybe ability, but just the way that you've moved through everything else in life afterwards?
I would describe myself, regardless of my nationality, my values, my core is very Indian. So the values of respect, duty, consideration, hospitality, those sort of values that you absorb as a child, they're not necessarily articulated, you know, as verbal lessons, but they're more just what you see around you and what you absorb and the way you're brought up. And that has stayed with me, and hopefully I pass it down to my children as well. So my values are very Indian at my core. And that is what it's given me. It's given me my heart, if you like, my early years. It's given me my love of India. And, you know, just when we say India, for me, it's technicolor. It's, you know, everything is bright, and whether it's the music or the arts or the movies that you might have experienced or the handicrafts or just the textiles, like it's just this riot of colors in my heart and my mind, as opposed to any other place that I've lived. And it's home. It is home. As much as London is home, as much as Dubai has been home for, you know, 20 plus years for me. But when I sort of arrive in India and I happen to be traveling there tomorrow, you know, I land and it's like, hi, mom, I'm back home kind of thought that goes up. So that's how I feel.
It's really cool. That's like an unspoken connection to a place. And while you have had other homes, there's just something a little bit different. I love that. So what is your vision and your mission moving forward for life?
Vision and mission, great words. So, to get the kids through university is mission number one.
That's a big one.
Vision for financial freedom, that's a big one. There was a new moon last night, so the wishes went up. I think it's mainly to live with integrity, right? And it's kind of what I've said on the website as well. It's about good thoughts, good words, good deeds. It's about allowing my dreams, working towards manifesting them, having big dreams. You know, even publishing the book started with a dream. It started with a few words that developed, and then I had the idea or the dream or the vision to be able to bring it to life. You know, I'd love for the book to become a movie. I think it's got great visual appeal and could be a really beautiful film. And it's just to live in harmony, which can be a little bit tricky in a corporate environment, but yeah, that's the vision. And yeah, we'll see how we go. One day at a time, I think.
That's all we can do. One day at a time. Are you ready for the final three questions?
Go for it.
Okay. The first one, which we kind of discussed off air, but what biases or bias do you have, and how do you challenge it?
So as we were talking off air, I think the one that I'm conscious of, because I have a daughter and a son, could be the gender bias, and mainly from, again, my upbringing and conditioning. And they call me out on it, and I love that they do. But if I'm in the kitchen and I call out to my daughter, she'll be like, why did you call out to me and not to her brother, my son? And it's a very fair call out on me. Or, you know, if there's something mechanical or technology related, I might instinctively call out to my son and not my daughter. Again, I have to check myself because she's equally capable of doing it. So, and it's interesting because in the house, I'm a single parent. I'm doing both the male and the female roles. So I embody both sides of that gender equation. And yet somehow I catch myself going back, reverting back to what might be a more traditional construct. So I do call myself, and the kids try and keep me honest on it.
So first of all, I love young people for their willingness and ability to call things out. I feel like they're living in a very different world. Just a short time after, you know, our own youth, they're living in a very different world that is far more connected, which means more informed, hopefully not misinformed, but that's another story for another day. But I just love their willingness to share, because I think it is so interesting. Your bias is also one that I have, which is also fascinating to me, because I'm very, you know, I build things, I can change my own oil, like I can change my own brakes, but I still, it's so deeply ingrained in us. It's very interesting. And that's one of the things that I am going for, is how can we at least acknowledge them? Because once we acknowledge them, I feel like we can start to counteract them, hopefully.
No, for sure. Oil and brakes, I still drive up to the garage and ask somebody to do it for me, but at least I do that, you know.
Oh, well, I don't do it myself now. I have done it in the past. I know how to do it, but yeah, I'm
well done, you know, to you,
someone else.
Yeah.
And so in your current phase of life, what are five words that you feel like you connect with personally that kind of describe where you're at, maybe?
Okay, so I was going to cheat a little bit because it might become six words. Yeah, and I was going, so integrity is very core to one of the values and the words that resonates with me, consideration. But then I thought, if I sum it up, it sort of sums up as good thoughts, good words, and good deeds, which is six words, not five. But I think if my thoughts are aligned to what I say, to my actions, I'm living in integrity, right? If I am, my thoughts and my words and my actions are aligned, and I'm not looking to harm anyone, I'm being considerate of people. So for me, that motto sums it up in a way, that philosophy from, you know, our faith, because in the end, it starts with how you think, how you speak, and what you do. And if you can balance those or find a way to do those with heart and integrity, then you're doing something right.
I love it. And there's no cheating, so don't worry. This is free society where you can use as many words as you'd like. I actually would love it if you would tell us a little bit more briefly about that, because that is, and maybe speak it in the original
text
language, or sure, the original words. Yeah. It's ancient Parsi maxim, is that correct?
So it's it reads as humata, which is good thoughts, hukata, which is good words, and huvarashta, which is good deeds. And my grandmother used to say this to me, my maternal grandmother who I grew up with. And I remember as a child, you know, trying to pull it apart in the literal sense, and she would be very patient with me. But again, as I've grown older, it just, that's kind of what it, the essence of it is, right? If you can be thinking good thoughts about people. So, you know, if you encounter someone who isn't as wide-minded or as accepting or as, you know, appreciative of differences in people, it's trying to stay kind-hearted with them, not, you know, taking it personal. Like the rejections, you're just like, it's okay, you know, it goes to the delete bin. And it's just making sure your actions, your considerate of other people. You are not looking to harm anyone. It doesn't mean you're a pushover at all. So, you know, that's not at all the messaging, but just you're not going out of your way to be, you know, hurtful to anyone else. And I think that's in today's world, if you can say you've done that, then I think that that's already a winning.
I love it. Okay, where can everyone go to connect with you, find your work, the book specifically?
We have a website, so it's farahpress.com. On the website, there are links to Amazon to download the book, but they can download it from any online retailer. And we're on Instagram, farah.press. So I hope they'll come and join me on the journey and keep up with what we're doing. And on the website, there are photographs of the people I talk about, of the world I lived in. So your listeners could get a little glimpse into that world. And hopefully enjoy the book that they read and let us know what they think.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing and particularly being vulnerable about the story about your mother. I think that takes a lot of courage to say out loud. So I really, really appreciate that. And I hope everyone will go to the show notes and grab your book.
Thank you so much. Really happy to have been here with you.
Thank you for joining this week's episode with Farah. I hope this episode helped you see a new perspective. I believe through conversations just like this, we can all set fire to our ignorance and rise from those ashes together as better humans. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions that we express on today's episode, they are our own. We encourage you to do your own research and come to your own conclusions. Connect with Farah by heading over to the show notes and finding the links there. You can check out breakingbiaspodcast.com, which is our website where you can find all our social media links and other important resources. If you enjoyed this episode, we would very much appreciate your feedback. Head on over to whatever platform you use that allows ratings and drop us a love note. If you haven't already, please hit subscribe wherever you're listening now so you never miss an episode. This does help us expand the dialogue by sharing our show with others. And until next time, don't forget to check your bias and keep the conversations going.